Long, long before the skies darkened on our island empire of Nippon, which the West called Japan, millennia passed, during which the common folk honored their emperor as the living descendant of the gods. And though the emperor was adored as divine, he had no true power. To deal in earthly mortal matters was to degrade his lofty position. Daimyos, or noblemen, took over the common chores of administering the empire. They held great prestige, and when combined with the practice of the samurai code, Bushido, the way of the warrior, they were the powers to be reckoned with, not the emperor.
Kane couldn't help but wonder if the daimyos held the same reverence for their god-king as the commoners did. To them, he was only an instrument by which power could be obtained, the population controlled, much like the way the baronies operated.
By the mid-20th century, Japan's martial philosophy had earned it the questionable distinction of being the first country to suffer from the effects of nuclear weapons. The nation put aside its katanas, its deification of samurai as folk heroes, and its exaltation of a noble death. Instead, it focused on technology and the harnessing of atomic power to make a safe and nearly eternal energy. By the end of the 20th century, our land of the rising sun was the premier economic power in the Pacific Basin. On January 20th, 2001, the day of the dark sky, a chain reaction triggered not only meltdowns, but explosions in Japan's nuclear reactors. Those in turn sparked volcanic eruptions and earthquakes of such magnitude, all of the smaller islands around Nippon sank without a trace. Northern Honshu, the largest province, was inundated by tsunamis, tidal waves 1,000 feet high, according to legend. All that remained of the land of the rising sun was a mountainous island, barely 150 miles long, and no more than 70 miles wide at its broadest point. By the time survivors crept out of shelters and climbed down from mountain peaks, almost none of the technology that had made the country a world power remained intact. But since we were an extraordinarily industrious race, we rebuilt our nation with the little we could salvage from the ruins. The first post-Skydark generation wrung its living from the sea, as had our ancestors centuries before. The old feudal system was revived as an extreme reaction to how westernized Nippon had become before the Holocaust. The new society was a return to the old ways of shoguns, samurai, and peasants. The peasants were put to work, utilizing what little resources remained on the island. Many of the old skills had been lost, and so the industries that sprang up on the coastal areas pumped pollutants and toxins into both the sea and the air. When a shogun by the name of Masashige attempted to reverse this poisoning of Nippon and end growing civil unrest by peaceful means, he was violently opposed by his own brother. Open warfare broke out, and the slaughter decimated both factions. Although Lord Masashige was gone, his memory and name lived on in his clan, in the house of Masashige. In the century following this disastrous coup, a new house came to prominence. The House of Ashikaga had once been the power in the land until overthrown by Masashige. This was a house comprised of heretic lords who came to prominence during the anarchy following the war between brothers. They were an uncultured clan whose family before Skydark were merchants, not nobles or warriors. By good fortune, cunning, and brutality incredible, even in a land of cruelty, they rose to wield unparalleled power. They swore to restore order and prosperity to Nippon as a basis to rally forces to them. Only the House of Masashige refused their support. It did not take long before the Ashikaga clan proved it was less devoted to restoring order to Nippon than to destroying the House of Masashige, wiping its seed from the face of the earth. To achieve such an end, the Ashikaga clan employed assassins, religious cults, and even private armies ruled by self-appointed warlords who served equally self-appointed god kings. These factions often fought among themselves, And so, the heads of the sword ruled the country, not the scepter. Death had no meaning, no honor. Due to these internecine conflicts, the country was in a state of civil war, with the lords and landowners choosing sides or straddling the fence, while paying lip service until they saw which way the stick would float. Many of them were disillusioned by the rule of the House of Ashikaga. The daimyo of the House of Mashishige, Lord Takaun, made one last attempt to not only reclaim his clan's power, but also to restore some semblance of order and dignity to his country. He failed, and the House of Ashikaga would not give him a second chance. They vowed to exterminate the Mashishige clan, to the last of the line. Lord Takaun had no choice but to flee, to go into exile. Taking with him as many family members, retainers, advisors, and samurai as a small fleet of ships could hold, they set sail into the Scific. Their destination was the island chain once known as the Hawaiians. But the heavens broke open with the unchained fury of the typhoon. The storm drove the little fleet far off course. The ships had no choice but to make landfall on the first halfway habitable piece of dry ground they came across. This turned out to be a richly forested isle, the tip of a larger landmass that had been submerged during the Nukost. Evidently, it had slowly risen from the waters over the past two centuries and supported a wide variety of animal and vegetable life. Lord Takaun decreed it would support theirs as well. The exiles from Nippon claimed it as their own and named it New Edo, after the imperial city of feudal Japan. Of course, there were many problems to overcome during the first few years of colonization. Demons and monsters haunted the craggy coves and inland forests. They had a malevolent intelligence and would creep into the camp at night to urinate in the well water or defecate in the gardens. More than one samurai was slain during that time, their heads taken. But the House of Mashishige not only persevered, it thrived, hacking out first a settlement, then an entire city from the wilderness, and now a new empire has risen, free of the corruption and cruelty of Nippon.
Kiyomasa stared dispassionately at Kane.
Well.
Well, what?
Well, that's the damnedest story I've heard in a long time.
Your view of our history is colored by your Gaijin perceptions.
What's Gaijin mean?
Foreigner.
I believe your captain has it backward. It's my country we're in.
Captain, how long ago was this?
8 years. Last month.
And in those 8 years, you made exploratory voyages to the other islands and to the mainland?
Hey, scouting and spying expeditions to what you call the Western Islands. They were overrun by mongrel pirates and Chinese. We did not care to treat with them. But at Port Morninglight, we were welcomed. New Edo has traded regularly with them for the past 3 years. They always treated us fairly and respectfully. They kept their word not to talk about us, to speak the location of New Edo. They were our friends.
So you were making one of your trading visits to Port Morninglight when you found it raised, and you decided to track the perps.
Pups?
Perpetrators.
Ah, so desu ka. English is almost a second tongue among my people, the old language of business and politics. Still, there are some nuances of it which we have yet to master.
You could have fooled me.
Shizuka threw a smile his way, and even Kane noticed how it was too wide to be simply an acknowledgement of Grant's compliment. He hoped Domi didn't notice it.
As we approached the port, we saw one of our friends warning us away.
Warning you how?
With signal fans we supplied them with. We taught them basic code maneuvers as well. I ordered our ship's smokescreen generator activated. It concealed us from the murderers. But it concealed them from our eyes as well.
When you came ashore, you decided to avenge the deaths of the people?
Aye, and to recover the prisoners and take them back to New Edo, if they wish it.
Why?
I thought you would understand, Kane-san. Port Morninglight and its citizens are under the protection of Lord Takaun. It is a matter of honor.
I do understand. And I hope you understand that while we don't want the mags to escape unpunished, we need at least one of them alive as a source of information.
Shizuka leaned toward Kiyomasa.
I shall reveal another reason why the murderers cannot be allowed to escape. I had a woman in Port Morninglight.
A woman?
My woman. She carried my child. I found her violated and shot through the belly and the head.
Cain felt a jolt of compassion and realized the samurai's unemotional demeanor was a pose, a facade. And with a sinking sensation in the pit of his stomach, he also realized he couldn't hope to dissuade Kiyomasa from walking the vengeance trail.
I'm very sorry to hear that, but it doesn't change things for me or my friends. The stakes are very high, and we need information from the men you stalk.
So desu. But tell us your tale, and why you need information from these murderers.
The group of 10 started off, leaving the corpses of the savages to lie unattended in the sand. Shizuka, Grant, and Cain replaced their helmets. The other tigers moved with a surprising degree of stealth, despite the amount of metal they wore and carried. During his story, Cain had revealed far more than simply identifying the raiders of Port Morninglight as magistrates to Kiyomasa. To save time, however, he had decided to provide an overview of the baronies. He described how the magistrates were the organizational descendants of a proposed global police force of the late 20th century, one that had judicial as well as law enforcement powers. He supplied only a few specifics, soft-peddling the patrilineal traditions of the Mags. There seemed little reason to conceal his and Grant's own long association with the magistrates. He stressed the kind of firepower used by the armored enforcers, so Kiyomasa would not become overconfident in the swords, bows, and ancient carbines carried by his tigers. Although he mentioned Cerberus, he did so only in passing and glossed over its actual location. It appeared Pollard's magistrates no longer cared about covering up their trail. The gauntlet of snakes had either spooked them so much they forgot to sweep their tracks, or they hoped any pursuers would fall prey to the bites of the Diamondbacks. Grant, who at first seemed inclined to walk beside Shizuka, dropped back to speak quietly to Bridget.
How much of Kiyomasa's story should we believe?
Without any evidence to contrary, we might as well accept all of it as gospel. Besides, the bare bones match up with an account in the Wyeth Codex.
Grant nodded, seeming to be both relieved and comforted. The Codex was a journal of sorts by Mildred Winona Wyeth, one of the enduring legends of the Deathlands. Born in the 20th century, Wyeth had slept through the New Cost and Skydark in cryonic suspension. She was revived after nearly 100 years by another semi-mythical figure of the Deathlands, Ryan Cotter. Wyeth joined Cotter's band of survivalists who journeyed the length and breadth of post-Holocaust America. At some point in her journeys, she found a working computer and recorded many of their experiences and adventures.
She even went to Japan?
And a lot of other places. She was one well-traveled lady.
As they walked, Bridget saw how Domi seemed content to lag behind, which both annoyed and disturbed her. She gestured for the girl to come forward, but she only shook her head. Bridget fervently hoped after her humiliation at the hands of Shizuka, Domi wasn't scheming some sort of payback. A 2-mile hike brought them to the crest of a low range, more of a sprawling foothill to the Sierra Nevadas. They stood at the brow of the hill and stared at the collection of ruins below them. The buildings of the town were gutted shells, its streets choked with rubble and debris. It was a settlement long dead, at least since the Nukost. Mesquite bushes grew in open courtyards bounded by the remnants of once tall walls and cluttered with the wreckage of long collapsed roofs. Scrubby grass grew in the pockets of wind-blown dust and weathered detritus.
Looks like you'll get in a little archaeology practice after all, Baptiste.
They looked down at the still-visible pattern of streets and lanes, laid out in a grid. A nearby river sparkled clearly in the moonlight, running slow and quiet. Not far downstream, it was joined by another flow of water.
They're down there. They could have gone around the place, but the fact they did not shows they intend to spend the night.
Cain and Grant silently agreed with her assessment. Pollard wouldn't want to trudge across the wasteland at night, regardless of the cooler temperatures. The town offered more shelter than sand dunes, and they could rest with a degree of comfort.
We shall find them easily.
Once we do, remember how revenge is not our mission priority.
Point out a murderer you wish spared. If at all possible, he will be. However, sparing child-killing cowards is not part of the Otoko no Michi.
The what?
The manly and honorable samurai tradition.
Kiyomasa looked over his shoulder to the tigers.
Fan out. Survey the area.
They slung their carbines over their shoulders, drew their swords, and fanned out.
Unclean weapons like guns have their uses, but only the katana, the sword, can quench the samurai's thirst for vengeance.
Kane contemplated the meaning of Kiyomasa's remark for a couple of seconds, then swiftly stepped to the lip of the ridge.
I'll take point. It's part of my tradition.
Kiyomasa stared at him with an indefinable expression on his face, then lowered his visor.
Aso desu ka, Kane-san.
Kane wasn't sure what he said, but he assumed, and hoped, Kiyomasa wasn't warning him to keep out of his way. Kane started his way slowly down the steep incline, his companions and the Tigers of Heaven following at a discreet distance. When he reached the outskirts of the ruins, he waited and watched and listened for a minute. There was something both fascinating and repellent about the houses, roofless and silent in the night. Many of the fallen walls showed black, glassy surfaces, as if they had been exposed to intense heat and the stones vitrified. Peeping through tangled vines here and there, he saw the rust-red streaks of what had once been vehicles, which gave him some idea of the many years the city had lain unattended. By the standards of the Outlands, scavengers should have put the wags to other uses long ago. He tried to find some hint for the cause of the city's collapse, but there was no sign of a single catastrophe, no bomb craters, no evidence of shelling. Despite the fact some of the ruins showed signs of fire blackening, others did not. Some buildings still stood among others that were no more than ragged foundations. Wide, dark bands of dried mud discolored many of the walls, from the ground to half their heights. Evidently, the two rivers tended to flood intermittently. Kane gestured and his party joined him, the tigers again impressing him with how quickly and relatively silently they moved in their armor. He stalked down a broad avenue. Farthest from the edge of the river, the city was better preserved than elsewhere. Here, most of the buildings still stood. They were low, long structures set upon terraces and facing curving streets. The streets were narrow, and they had to keep to the center, for the bushes and creepers had narrowed it still further. Many of the plants bore flowers, and Bridget wondered aloud if they had once been part of gardens that overgrew and overflowed to make a continuous thicket. The area had all the appearances of a residential section of the city, what she knew were once called suburbs.
I think this place was what the pre-darkers called a commuter community, a specially built or expanded township for people who worked in large metropolitan areas but didn't want to live or raise their children there.
Bridget then noticed a big square of plastic rearing from the ground, almost covered by bramble bushes. It depicted a cartoony sun wearing a big smile, a sombrero, and dark glasses. The bright red copy read, "Welcome to Vista del Sol. Our future's so bright we need shades." Kane didn't know whether to laugh or scoff. On impulse, as they passed one of the rambling houses, Kane strode up a walk to peer inside. Grant, Domi, and Bridget followed him, the tigers waiting out on the street. The doorway was wide and tall. The wooden frame disintegrated into fine powder when he brushed against it with a shoulder. Inside, all was a shambles. Dead leaves filled the hallways, and the rooms showed evidence of being long unused nests for vermin. The interior smelled musty, which was not surprising, but it also held another odor, faint but detectable.
Wood smoke.
They followed the scent out of the residential section and down a side lane. The street ahead of them looked as if it had been a mix of storefronts and apartment buildings. Many of the structures lacked roofs, and there wasn't a single pane of glass visible in any of the windows. Kane once again took the point, leading them quickly along the narrow, overgrown alleys and through deep shadow between roofless walls. They passed doorways leading into nothing but darkness. The odor of smoke thickened. The alley took a sharp turn and butted up against the base of a high wall, about 8 feet tall. It extended from the side of a multi-storied apartment complex, forming a wide square enclosure on its rear side. The designers of the building had gone in for a Spanish mission-style architecture, meant to evoke the days of hidalgos and caballeros. Fake adobe covered over bricks, and a square bell tower-like cupola rose from the top of the structure. Most of the adobe stucco had peeled away from the walls decades before, revealing the mortared brick beneath. Thick flowering vines sprouted from the brickwork. Using hand signals, Kane informed his party of his intentions. Kiyomasa nodded brusquely, and he and Grant made a stirrup out of their hands. They heaved Kane high enough so he could see what lay on the other side of the wall. In a spacious but litter-strewed courtyard, a few magistrates were pacing restlessly, but most of them sat around a small fire, eating their rations from the self-heat packages. They stared at the flames and smothered yawns. Several of the mags lounged on the flagstones with their helmets off, Pollard included. Kane recognized several: Franklin, Hotchkiss, Brady, a few others he knew by sight but not by name. An empty swimming pool, half filled with scraggly tumbleweeds and debris, served as the prisoners' holding cell. They huddled together against a curving wall. All of them looked exhausted, their faces haggard and begrimed. They were fed scantily by a mag and given enough water to keep life in them, but not much more. Their fetters were not loosened, but they were allowed to sprawl around as they might. Pollard stood some distance from the fire, a cup of coffee sub in his ungloved right hand. He gazed vacantly at the pool, not really seeing it, as if he were lost in thought. Kane saw the faint scar bisecting his right eyebrow, the memento of the day Grant rescued Lakesh from the Cobaltville cell blocks. He wished Grant hadn't left the bastard alive, or at the very least had crippled him. Kane and Grant had known Pollard for years, and they had never liked him. He was a simple, brutal, uncompromising man, always towing the mark and obeying his superior's orders without question. He made the perfect blunt instrument, and in Pollard's mind, that quality made him the ideal magistrate. More than once, he had evinced jealousy of Kane's and Grant's reputations. Kane saw equipment packs piled in a corner on the opposite side of the compound from the prisoners. Other than the Sin Eaters, the only blasters in sight were the standard-issue copperheads. He figured Grens were stowed somewhere, since they were part of the normal hard-contact complement of ordnance. Kane made a swift head count and noticed 4 of the 20 magistrates were nowhere in sight. He assumed they were on sentry duty somewhere outside the walled compound, patrolling the perimeter. A wide, dark doorway gaped in the side of the building, but he doubted any of the mags were inside. It was very defensible ground Pollard had chosen. The only opening in the wall was a narrow, arched entranceway. He gestured to Kiyomasa and Grant. They eased him down to the ground, and he strode back into the alley, indicating the others should follow him.
We've got 4 mags unaccounted for. They're on guard somewhere, so we've got to be on triple red. If we're spotted and they raise an alarm, Pollard and his men could hold us off for a long time.
What do you suggest?
We'll split up. I'll get inside the building and come up on them from the inside. The rest of you circle the zone, find the guards and take them out. Secure the way into and out of the compound.
Hey, a sound strategy.
One more thing. I've spotted the man we need alive. His name is Pollard. Disable him if you have to, but don't kill him.
Turning to the 4 tigers, they each nodded their understanding. Kane opened the war bag and removed 3 Grens, a CS gas canister, and a pair of Alcatex concussion flashbangs.
I'll go with you.
Bridget reached for a concussion Gren. Domi gave Grant and Shizuka a narrow-eyed glance and extended her hand to Kane.
Me too.
Kane handed her a flashbang.
Be careful with it.
I'm not a child.
Grant stepped beside Shizuka, and facing Kane, he lifted his right index finger to his nose and snapped it away in the wry 1% salute. It was a gesture he and Kane had developed during their mag days and reserved for undertakings with small ratios of success. Kane returned it gravely.
Let's get it done.
Grant, Shizuka, Odo, and Jizure crept around the north side of the sprawling apartment complex, while Kiyomasa, Ibichi, and Kuroda circled southward. They kept to wedges of shadow, angling toward the dark, overgrown areas. Shizuka took the point, astonishingly fast and agile in her armor. She darted quickly into and out of the spots of best cover with barely a sound. While Grant and the 2 tigers stayed closely to the shadow of the wall, Shizuka crept away at an oblique angle. Grant watched her with frank admiration. He couldn't deny his attraction to the woman. She exuded self-confidence, a slightly self-deprecating sense of humor, and despite her warrior trappings, a gentleness of spirit. She was certainly more mature than Domi, both in years and behavior. And there was something about her that penetrated his guarded reserve. He didn't know exactly what it was, but she touched his inner core in a way only one other woman had done in his life. Olivia, the only woman who'd truly claimed his heart. A shadow suddenly shifted behind Shizuka, a shape blacker than the darkness. A mag glided soundlessly out of the gloom, combat knife in one fist and Sin Eater in the other. He wasn't wearing his helmet, and in a split second, Grant understood the man's strategy. Removing his helmet in a potential kill zone was more than unforgivably stupid. It was a major breach of hard contact protocols. Without his helmet, the mag couldn't relay a report about an intruder. His only option was to try to take out Shizuka with the knife rather than a blaster, which would possibly alert other intruders skulking around the perimeter. Grant was about to yell a warning when Shizuka spun faster than anyone he'd ever seen, whirling on the ball of one foot and coming up with a two-handed stroke. The blade sliced off the mag's right arm just below the elbow. Coming up from under his armpit without ceasing her movement, she circled back, ready to deliver a second slash if necessary. It wasn't. The magistrate, who had just lost his arm, gazed with wonder at his limb lying on the ground, the hand still holding his Sin Eater. As blood continued to pour from the stump of his arm, he fell to his knees, then on his face. Grant, Jizure, and Odo joined Shizuka around the body, staring at the blood-damp katana in wonder.
What the flash-blasted hell is that sword made out of?
Steel, of course.
Shizuka reached beneath her breastplate, taking out a scrap of silk. She carefully wiped the blood from the blade.
Steel can't cut through mag armor like that, or it shouldn't be able to.
It's a new process, or rather, an old one, rediscovered about 20 years ago by Lord Takaun.
Kiyomasa said the old sciences had been lost.
A century ago, most of them had been, but not all of them remained so. Did Kane-san reveal everything about your magistrates and your barons?
Point taken.
Shizuka turned to Odo and Jizure.
Hide his body.
They took hold of the magistrate and his severed arm, dragging both out of sight into a tangle of shrubbery. The four people then resumed their circuit around the walled courtyard. This time, Grant assumed the point position. If they encountered another sentry, the sight of a man in the black armor wouldn't instantly drive him to the attack. Their progress was achingly slow, since they had to pick their way over a scattering of broken masonry, most of it butting up against the wall.
Claremont, is that you?
Grant turned slowly, trying to pinpoint the source of the voice. A dozen yards to his right, a magistrate stepped out, this one wearing his helmet. Grant didn't recognize his jawline or voice.
Yes.
The mag strode toward him.
I'm so sick of this shit. Nobody's following us, so why can't we keep moving? Do you have your canteen with you?
It wasn't until the mag stood nearly toe-to-toe with Grant that he realized he wasn't addressing Claremont. He opened his mouth and raised his Sin Eater simultaneously. Grant's left fist hammered upward, catching the magistrate under the jaw, twisting his head back brutally on his neck. Grant was not as fast as Kane, but he was a good deal stronger, and when he struck, he usually struck only once. Shizuka, Jizure, and Odo swiftly stepped over to him.
Your technique may be straightforward to the point of crudity, but I can't argue with the effect.
The tip of Jizure's blade lightly touched the narrow strip of flesh visible between the mag's high-collared undersheathing and his helmet, probing for the carotid artery.
No!
Grant launched a kick at the katana. Jizure snatched it away with lightning speed, causing Grant to stagger. The Tiger of Heaven instantly assumed an offensive posture, sword positioned for a double-handed stroke.
No killing of the guards unless absolutely necessary.
Is this a man you know?
He's only following orders, like Kane and I did when we were officers like him. He probably didn't want to take part in the massacre of the settlement, but he had no choice.
Directing violence against members of his former brotherhood still caused Grant pangs of guilt. He retained vivid memories of the firefight with Cobaltville Mags when he, Kane, Domi, and Bridget made their escape. They were not memories he relished. Grant said nothing more, though he sometimes questioned himself about his reluctance to kill magistrates when they would have no such qualms if the situation were reversed. The magistrate division, for all of its many faults, had been the only true home he had ever known. It was where he had grown to manhood, where his personality and identity had been formed. No matter how far away from the division he might run, both in distance and experience, he could never completely outdistance its oaths and its disciplines. In the remote recesses of his mind, the division was his home, not Cerberus. Bending over the unconscious man, Grant swiftly disarmed him, appropriated his copperhead, and searched through the pouches on his web belt. He bound the man's wrists with the standard mag nylon cuffs. He fashioned a gag with the man's web belt and removed his helmet to make sure he couldn't comm call for help. The magistrate looked frighteningly young, almost like a child. and there was something vaguely familiar about his soft features. Grant dragged him deep into a brush-clogged thicket by the ankles, acutely aware of how foolish his humanitarian efforts appeared to the samurai.
Let us waste no more time.
Although he wanted to, Grant did not object.
We're set, Grant.
We're not. Stand by for my signal.
Standing by.
It didn't seem likely they would come across any more sentries before they reached the entrance to the courtyard. Pollard had obviously stationed two on the north side and two on the south. He only hoped Kiyomasa would dispatch the ones on that side efficiently and silently. With infinite caution, Kane crept sideways, crouched, listened, but heard nothing. He stalked along the corridor, aware of Bridget and Domi behind him. He kept close to the right-hand wall, and the two women walked down the center so they would have a clear field of fire. The plaster on the walls was cracked where it wasn't broken altogether, and large pieces of it were scattered on the terracotta-tiled floor. Despite the lack of humidity, the air tasted dank and stale, as if they were creeping through a mausoleum. Most of the rooms on either side of the hall showed as black as pitch, but several were dimly lit by the ghostly moonlight peeping in through rents in the roof. They were far from bare, but their contents had not withstood the merciless double team of time and the elements. They were littered with haphazard heaps of unidentifiable junk. He hoped Bridget the historian didn't feel cheated. They reached a T-junction in the hallway and paused. On the right, a flight of rickety and sagging stairs angled up into darkness. Kane moved on, senses alert, finger lightly touching the trigger stud of his Sin-Eater. They reached a point where their path was blocked by a jumbled barricade of fallen timbers and support beams, so they had to work their way over and around and through them. It was a tight squeeze, even for Domi. Turning a corner, Kane saw the double doorway leading directly into the courtyard. Crouching, he motioned for Domi and Bridget to take up positions on either side of it. He kept his eyes fixed on Pollard, watching his every move, and opened the comlink channel to Grant.
We're set, Grant.
We're not. Stand by for my signal.
Standing by.
With hand motions, Kane told Bridget and Domi to throw their Alcatex Grens when he gave the word. He would follow with the canister of CS gas. The three devices weren't lethal, but they would cause the prisoners some discomfort. However, it was a far safer solution than employing the high-X Grens in his war bag. As it was, with the people below ground level in the pool, they weren't likely to be caught in a crossfire. Kane waited for Grant's communication, barely able to stop himself from fidgeting. Like all hard-contact magistrates, Kane hated forestalling preemptive action. The moments directly preceding action were the hardest to endure. But since he had spent years as a hard-contact mag, he also knew that real violence often came without warning. The mags galvanized in the courtyard like they had received electric shocks. They scrambled to their feet, snatching weapons and helmets. Pollard lumbered swiftly toward the entranceway.
Get to your positions!
Shit!
The two women then turned questioning faces toward Kane.
Do it!
Domi and Bridget unpinned their grens and tossed them into the compound. A pair of stars seemed to go nova, and intolerable white glares blazed, bleaching all of the shadows out of the courtyard. The magistrates nearest the epicenters of the explosions were stunned and deafened, and those without their helmets were blinded, their optic nerves overwhelmed. While other mags reeled in shock, trying to bring their blasters to bear, Kane pinched the gas gren's pin and hurled the gren with a looping overarm. It passed through the doorway, trailing out a little stream of acrid vapor. A billowing plume of white smoke rose from the gren, and almost immediately the courtyard was engulfed by clouds of roiling vapor.
All blasters! The doorway!
Two of them aimed their copperheads at the doorway of the building. Kane could barely see flame wreathing the stuttering muzzles through the blinding smoke, but the bullets turned the wall behind him into a sieve. Dark shapes shifted through the planes of gas, fanning out to approach their position inside the doorway. The chemical vapors wafted into the building.
You two stay where you are. Don't move.
Kane stepped out into the center of the corridor, framing himself in the opening. He allowed himself to be seen. Just to make sure, he aimed his copperhead at the nearest black figure. As he did so, he realized the man wasn't wearing his helmet, and his weeping eyes were but slits in his face. Kane then realized he recognized the man, but it was too late. His features dissolved in a wet blur, blood spraying out of his throat like a fountain. Staggering from the impact, Kane flailed backward into the gloom of the corridor, his feet scrambling for purchase on the floor. Though his armor had absorbed and distributed most of the high-caliber bullet's kinetic energy, he was numbed, his heart quivering from hydrostatic shock. If the round had struck his molded pectoral directly, he knew his heart would have stopped beating.
What the fuck's going on, Kane?
Kane had only enough oxygen to either run or answer. He could not do both. He glimpsed four mags bullying through the door, gripping their sin eaters and copperheads. They did not see either of the women crouched in the dark corners on either side of them. Kane turned and ran. Grant suddenly broke into a sprint, dashing around the corner of the wall and making for the entranceway into the courtyard. He opened the comlink to Kane.
What the fuck's going on, Kane?
There was no reply. A mag pushed his way through the arch, raised his sin eater, then checked the motion. He started to call out to Grant, but when he spotted the Tigers of Heaven running up behind him, the man tried to bring his blaster to bear again, but Grant beat him to it. The hailstorm of bullets didn't breach the armor, but the kinetic shock was sufficient to numb him and slam all the air out of his lungs. He reeled back into the courtyard. A magistrate came around the south corner of the wall, but he wasn't running. He stumbled dazedly, hands over his midsection. Falling to his knees, he put out his hands to catch himself. When he did so, blue-sheened intestines fell from a slash in his armor, spilling in a wet and pulsing mass to the ground. Kiyomasa, Ibichi, and Kuroda came around the corner a breath later. Kiyomasa's sword gleamed with blood. Its razor edge had sheared through the mag from groin to chest. On his knees, the mag tried to scrape up his intestines and push them back into his belly through the gash in his armor. He raised his face to Grant and tried to speak. The katana in Kiyomasa's hands flashed. The magistrate's head fell from his shoulders, the mouth open and lips moving as if it had one last thing it wanted to say.
This pig managed to get off a few shots before I could attend to him. I apologize.
Grant said nothing, ignoring the quiver of nausea in his stomach. When Kiyomasa made a motion to enter the courtyard, Grant put out a restraining hand.
Wait until the gas dissipates. You'll have plenty to do out here.
Quartet of magistrates then staggered out of the entranceway. When they saw the Tigers of Heaven and Grant, they simply froze, not knowing what to do. The samurai went into whirling attacks, their katanas surgically dismembering the mags. One man stared in disbelief at the stump where his gun hand once was. The edge of the sword then sliced through the neck of his companion. The mag with the amputated hand opened his mouth to scream, but a sword blade lifted and fell between eye blinks. The other two magistrates broke through the samurai, racing like panicked deer for the river. The tigers pursued them only a little way, bounding like their feline namesakes, their katanas licking out. Blood rushed from piercing wounds in their backs, and the two men turned to fight. Grant did not engage them. Neither magistrate managed to squeeze off a single shot when four Tigers of Heaven closed in around them. It was not a fight. It was a slaughter. Within seconds, the magistrates floated face down in the water, blood spreading away from their bodies. Then the weight of their armor pulled them beneath the surface and out of sight. Jaw muscles bunched, Grant turned away, back toward the walled-in compound.
You don't approve of our fighting style?
That wasn't a fight. It was butchery.
The honorable act would have been for them to bow their heads and accept the killing punishment they earned.
Grant held his breath and pushed out through the archway into the courtyard, plunging into the plains of gas. He tried to stay beneath the drifting clouds of chemical vapor. Grant's breath burned in his throat, his eyes still tearing from the tainted air, but it would have been far worse without his visor. A black armored figure came to a stop in front of him. He started to speak, then spotted Shizuka at his side. He whipped his copperhead to his shoulder. Grant lifted the sin eater first.
So domo arigato. Thank you. I didn't expect you to do that.
I said no unnecessary killing. He didn't give anybody a choice.
Grant moved deeper into the courtyard, squinting against the burn of CS gas hanging in the air. He started to whirl, and metal flashed at the periphery of his vision. A magistrate staggered back from Shizuka, who had her sword angled over her left shoulder. Blood bubbled up in a precise line across his torso. The cut was from the juncture of the neck just above the seventh vertebrae, then through the collarbone, angling to the sternum, slicing through the cartilage and spinal column. The mag's body separated into two parts, each side sliding wetly to the ground. Grant stared in amazement and revulsion. Before he could say anything, he saw more mags racing across the courtyard. He also glimpsed Pollard waving his copperhead at the men. Grant brought up both of his blasters. A mag was hit broadside and pulled off his feet. Return fire ripped the air around Grant. Holding down the triggers of his copperhead and sin eater, he swung the flame-belching barrels from left to right. He found himself subconsciously aiming for the red badges emblazoned on the left pectorals of the body armor. With swift, sure hands, Grant toggled the Copperhead's magazine release, then rammed a fresh one home. The thinning clouds of chemical vapor suddenly lit up with a hot, hell-hued white flash, like heat lightning contained within the walls of the building. Grant instinctively lifted an arm to shield himself. In that instant, Pollard stitched Grant across the midriff with a zipper of slugs. Before Grant's body had fully settled, Domi took action. Other mags raced into the building after Kane as the fog-shrouded courtyard was lit up with a bright white flare. Bridget felt the heat on the back of her head. Instinctively, she crouched in an even tighter ball, punching her head between her shoulders.
Be more careful!
Domi said nothing, her eyes fixed on the supine Grant. He climbed to his feet as they watched, but their view of him was blocked by running figures. If nothing else, Domi's reaction to Grant's dilemma proved to Bridget that her anger toward him was superficial in nature and didn't pollute her deep wellspring of devotion.
Bastard fucking forces!
Knuckling the grit from her eyes, Domi sprang out of the shelter of the doorway like a snow leopard pouncing on prey. Bridget watched in morbid fascination as Domi sought out magistrates. When one of them loomed out of the misty veils, pointing his sin-eater directly at her head, Domi instantly ducked and sidestepped. She lashed out with a leg, and her foot clipped him solidly on the back of his right ankle. Domi cartwheeled up and onto the man, landing on his abdomen. Her right foot, with all of her weight behind it, drove up and beneath his visor. Scarlet streaks contrasted sharply with his black armor. Domi heeled away from his death throes, turned and waved for Bridget to join her. Double-fisting her Ivor Johnson, Bridget left the building. Smoke rolled down the corridor from the epicenter of the Gren explosion. She couldn't be certain, but she doubted the mags had thrown the Gren. More than likely, Kane had done so to discourage pursuit. A mag appeared in the murky vapors, assuming a combat stance, Sin-Eater held in both hands. Neither Domi nor Bridget could see at whom or what he was aiming, but sighting down the barrel of her blaster, Domi took action. A splash of blue sparks jumped from the frame of the Sin-Eater, and the mag stumbled sideways, shaking nerve-dead fingers. The black-helmeted head pivoted toward her, mouth opening wide to utter a shriek of pain and anger, but Domi calmly aimed at his open mouth. Bridget did not allow herself to feel horror. As always in a combat situation, her mind seemed to disengage from her emotions, her thoughts functioning in a matrix of reaction and analysis. She turned toward the flashing steel and saw the Tigers of Heaven. Bridget tried to find Pollard among the drifting scraps of chemical fog and running figures, but her vision was blurred by CS-induced tears. She instead framed the nearest mag in her sights. She altered direction, racing toward the pool. A mag was trying to maintain a guard on the prisoners, but was still having trouble seeing in the fog. A bullet plucked at her hair, ripping a few strands out by the roots. Arms and hands reached up to latch onto the magistrate's legs and haul him backward.
No, you bastards! Get off me!
A Tiger of Heaven materialized beside her, as if conjured out of the CS fog. When he lifted his faceplate and threw Bridget a grin, she recognized the features of Josure. Two mags rushed him from opposite directions, trying to get Josure between them so as to catch him in a crossfire. He danced away, the katana in his hands flicking back and forth, reflecting little white flares of light. The barrels of the Sin-Eaters tried to follow his movements.
Hey!
Josure made a low, whirling movement, squatted, then propelled his body into the air at the exact microsecond both blasters trained on him. The bullet struck the armored men in the torsos, sending them staggering. Josure pivoted, his katana cutting wheels through the fading streamers of gas. His dodging dance came to a halt, no more than a yard from Pollard. The moon-faced man's lips writhed back from his stumpy teeth. He held down the trigger of his copperhead, sending a full-auto fusillade ripping into the metal-sheathed abdomen of Josure. The Tiger of Heaven went over backward and curled into a ball, the carbine as well as the silver sword spinning from his hands. Pollard swung the barrel toward Bridget, his little eyes glinting first in recognition, then astonishment. His finger froze on the trigger for a shaved shred of a second as he tried to figure out what a convicted seditionist was doing with a group of armored, sword-wielding madmen. Although Pollard was momentarily paralyzed by confusion, a magistrate sprinting up from the direction of the courtyard entrance wasn't so impaired. Bridget threw herself forward in a frantic somersault, trying to stay ahead of the deadly stream of lead. She shoulder-rolled across the ground and snatched up Josure's fallen carbine. She raised it hastily, surprised by its heavy weight. She put it to her shoulder and framed Pollard in the blade sights. Gritting her teeth, Bridget set herself and drew another bead on the man. Pollard stared in astonishment, then an ugly leer twisted his lips. Bouncing to her feet, Bridget flung the carbine out in front of her. The metal plate of the stock smashed into Pollard's forehead, sending him staggering against the magistrate standing beside him.
Get her!
As they managed to align her running figure in front of their blasters, a small metal-shelled ovoid landed between her and the mags.
Look out!
Move!
Pollard and the other magistrate started to run. Bridget hitched around on her left side, raking her hair out of her eyes. Grant lunged through the eye-stinging haze, holding his copperhead. Pollard and the other magistrate whirled and ran toward the building. He glimpsed Pollard throwing his subgun aside as they both raced into the dark mouth of the double doorway. Grant halted to one side of the opening to reload his hand blaster. He winced at the ache in his chest. Pins and needles burned through his torso. Blinking back tears of pain from his eyes, he moved into the building at once.
Grant!
He crept along the hall, his head swiveling back and forth to peer into shadows. He had gone only a few yards down the corridor when his peripheral vision caught a twinkle of light reflecting dimly from an egg-shaped object down the corridor ahead of him. He dived backward, twisting to land on his shoulder on the tiled, debris-littered floor. The high-ex grin erupted in a flash of orange flame and white smoke. A hellflower bloomed, petals of flame curving and spreading out. Ugly black fissures spread out in a spiderweb pattern in the ceiling. The walls cracked open like overripe fruit. The ceiling split in the middle and folded downward like a double lid.
Shit!
The rain of splinters, planks, and steel braces half covered him. Blinded and nearly smothered, Grant struggled against the pressure of the debris covering him from upper chest to the toes of his boots. His visor was occluded by smears of dust, and kernels of grit stung his eyes and set them to watering. His right arm, his gun arm, was trapped beneath him, the Sin Eater's barrel snagged on shards of wood and impeded by metal reinforcing rods. Frantically, he tried to free himself, but the plaster broke into fragments when he secured finger holds. He glimpsed a black-armored form sliding out of the dust-laden air. Then a heavy weight landed on his rubble-covered chest.
I wasn't sure it was you, Grant.
The magistrate stomped hard on the layers of plaster and sheetrock covering Grant's chest.
Couldn't be, I told myself. But it is, isn't it? Grant the traitor. McMurphy? One and the same.
McMurphy was a man he had served with for many years and with whom he had shared the dangers of the Mesa Verde penetration that had started the chain of events leading to his exile. He had also been forced to shoot him during his rescue of Lakesh some months ago.
You should have chilled me in Cobaltville, Grant.
I didn't try to chill you. The object was to discourage you.
You managed to do that, you son of a bitch. After you got away, I was booted back down the ranks. I've been pulling pit patrol duty for the last 6 months. I was in line for an administrative transfer. I should have had it by now. But it was all taken away. Everything. I even have to live in the fucking barracks now.
The man's Sin Eater slid into his hand. The hollow bore peered down at Grant like a cyclopean eye.
This mission was my one chance to redeem myself, but you fucked it up. But a traitor like you doesn't care, doesn't believe in anything, doesn't understand anything about honor, oath, or duty.
Grant managed to work his blaster free of the crushing weight just enough to tilt back the barrel through the slabs of debris.
I understand perfectly.
Clasping at his groin, McMurphy reeled backward, his feet sliding and seeking purchase on the debris-strewn floor. Raising a shaking arm, he pointed his Sin Eater at Grant, but Bridget and Domi came up behind him. The man's face dissolved in a wet scarlet blur on the floor near Grant. Domi and Bridget kneeled on either side of him.
Are you all right?
Thanks to you two.
Together, they helped him dig out.
The surviving mags had surrendered to the Tigers of Heaven.
Grant kicked his legs free, crawled back a few feet, then rose unsteadily.
I don't know if giving up will do the mags any good. The Tigers don't seem inclined to take prisoners.
Kane told Kiyomasa he only wanted Pollard spared, and then only for questioning.
Grant paused, looking down the ruin of the corridor. He could not be sure, but he thought a couple of the objects protruding from the heap of rubble were polycarbonate-shod arms and legs.
Where the hell is Pollard, anyway?
More importantly, where the hell is Kane?